Lecture 22, The Etruscan World Falls Apart.
Many histories of the ancient world, if they address the Etruscans at all, turn away from them in the 3rd or 4th century BC, and we're left to assume that they disappeared. Well, I'm here to tell you that the Etruscans didn't, and to fill in the gaps with the fascinating stories of their final centuries as a distinct culture and society. After hundreds of years fighting against invaders, they weren't going to just roll over and start learning Latin. Etruscan culture would continue to develop, altered perhaps, but still there, through the centuries of Roman occupation and rule. Well, we should start with a bit of history to see how the current presentation developed. It's understandable that the relentless chorus of Etruscan military losses would lead to the conclusion that they were gone by the 3rd century BC. The closest Etruscan city to Rome, Veii, was besieged and taken by the Romans in 396 BC, and this might seem the beginning of the end. But remember that the Etruscan cities were all independent city-states, and so the loss of one sovereign state wouldn't inevitably spell the end of them all. From 358 to 351 BC, the Etruscans, led by Tarquinia, fought a brutal war against Rome that included the retaliatory sacrifices of each other's prisoners. The ensuing truce lasted another 40 years before another round of Roman-Etruscan wars started in 311 BC. These were fought by virtually all of the Etruscan cities, although apparently not in a coordinated fashion. Contrary to their collective interests, some Etruscans broke away from battle to send help to Syracuse against the Carthaginians, although others, notably at Arezzo, revolted against the aristocratic Roman allies ruling their community. Many other peoples of central Italy joined the Etruscans in the conflict with the Romans, including the Samnites, Umbrians, and Gauls. Rome suffered a number of losses, but being Rome, never stopped. It eventually won a number of decisive victories in 294, 293, and 280 BC over Tarquinia, Orvieto, and Volci. Finally, in 273 BC, Cerveteri and Volci lost half of their territory when the Romans decided to occupy Etruria rather than rely on rule through treaties or truces. The Roman colony of Cosa was founded along with another at Paestum in 273 BC, marking the first Roman military occupation of these coastal communities and a shift in their policy of containment to one of occupation. In the Etruscan communities themselves, the Romans selected allies who effectively exploited class struggles in the cities to ally themselves with aristocratic families against the lower classes. In the most dramatic occupation, the Romans occupied Orvieto, the city closest to the Great Etruscan League Sanctuary, and in 264 BC, relocated the bulk of the population to Bolsena and razed the city to the ground. The 3rd to 1st centuries BC, if viewed only politically by the truces and treaties that separate Etruscan city-states made with Rome, might signify the end of Etruscan culture. It was not. Rather, there was something of a cultural renaissance among many Etruscan cities at that time. Greek artistic influences continued to permeate the arts, and Etruscan connections with Greek communities through trade and exchange seemed to be just as strong as they were prior to the Great Wars. Etruscan sanctuaries continued to thrive, except, of course, for Pyrgi and the League sanctuary outside Orvieto, which were wiped out. Sanctuaries were one of the most important places where public identity was created and shared. The temple of Ara della Regina at Tarquinia, the longest Etruscan temple ever yet discovered, reached its greatest size in the 3rd century BC. 252 feet long by 115 feet wide. By comparison, the Etruscan-style Temple of Jupiter on the Capitoline Hill in Rome measured 220 feet long by 180 feet, or about 80% of the area of an American football field. The Ara della Regina Temple also provides stunning examples of terracotta work, including an amazing high-relief work of two winged horses drawing a chariot. It is one of the true masterpieces of Etruscan art and dates to this period of war and occupation. Now, it's possible, of course, that a re-emphasis on religious identity by the Etruscans might have been a result of the Roman threat to their political identity. We see that same pattern in Rome during this exact same period. When threatened with destruction by Hannibal from 218 to 204 BC, Rome turned to religion to ensure the support of the gods and to reinforce the value of their own culture, even performing human sacrifice. Well, there was also a shift in the tone of wall paintings in Etruscan tombs during this period. The familiar images of banqueting couples seemed to shift from celebratory to mourning, as if overtaken by the sadness of the world around them. We also see a rise in demonic imagery, as if the idealized happy afterlife is now further away than ever. But it's not just in the variations on traditional imagery where we see the effects of this period. Let's look at the subjects from myth found on the cinerary urns from Perugia, which I believe show us myth as a mirror of Etruscan society. Originally one of the 12 major cities of the Etruscan League, Perugia took a leading role in the Etruscan Wars of the 4th and early 3rd century BC, until it was defeated and signed a truce with Rome in 295 BC. Afterwards, the myth of Iphigenia becomes one of the most commonly found on urns at Perugia. For those unfamiliar, it's one of the events during the build-up to the Trojan War. The Greeks were at the city of Aulis, preparing to launch their fleet towards Troy. Their commander-in-chief, Agamemnon, had, unfortunately, angered the goddess Artemis, who responded by holding their ships in port. Agamemnon consulted the seer Calchas, who told him that Artemis would be placated only by the sacrifice of Agamemnon's eldest daughter, Iphigenia. In a classic life-work balance conflict, Agamemnon was being asked to choose between his role as father and his role as commander of the Greek forces. He chose the latter. After luring his daughter and her mother to him under false pretenses, Iphigenia ultimately goes willingly to her fate, allowing herself to be sacrificed for the cause. Well, how can we account for the popularity of this image in Perugia? First, it's important to rule out the idea, as attractive as it is, that this subject was selected for the urns of girls who died young. A study of the bones in these urns reveals that 13% belonged to young females, 56% to males, and 31% were of mature females. So the idea that the occupant was a bride of death was not universally true. Rather, the majority were men, meaning that we can dismiss an explicitly biographical rationale. We might consider the sacrifice of Iphigenia a generalized representation of the deceased at the moment of death. But there's no way to know if all of these people died in some self-sacrificing way, although it seems unlikely that a disproportionate number of Perugians did so. Possibly, I suppose, but unlikely. Because Etruscan art is socially normative, that is, subjects were selected to convey positive social values, then perhaps the subject isn't biographical at all, but rather an ideal conveying values without explicit reference to the occupant's life. If we widen our view to look at the other popular mythological subjects on urns from Perugia at this same period, I think we can detect a pattern. After the sacrifice of Iphigenia, the next most popular subjects of urn decorations are the ambush of Troilus by Achilles, another event that takes place during the Trojan War, and the mutual fratricide of Eteocles and Polynices, sons of Oedipus, who, in their succession struggle, meet on the battlefield and kill each other simultaneously. All three of these subjects have some common themes. Each portrays someone in the moment of death. The central figure in each myth is also dying for some reason or cause. Iphigenia to launch the fleet against Troy, Troilus to ensure the Greek victory at Troy, and Eteocles and Polynices in their conflict for the throne of Thebes. Two of these are arguably role models, while the third, the tale of the sons of Oedipus, provides instead a cautionary tale against hubris. By failing to follow their father's wishes, they hastened their own deaths. Iphigenia and Troilus have another element in common, prophecy, an enduring obsession of the Etruscans. Iphigenia's fate was revealed by the prophet Calchas, while, according to other prophecies, Troy could not be destroyed if Troilus grew to adulthood. Achilles killed Troilus to remove this obstacle to his conquest of Troy. The sacrifice of Iphigenia allows the Greeks to sail to Troy, but Iphigenia's mother harbors some not unreasonable resentment for the sacrifice of her eldest daughter. Upon Agamemnon's homecoming, she arranges a welcome in which she and her lover kill him. Then Orestes, the surviving son, revenges his father by killing his mother and the lover. It's a very up story. Everyone involved is guilty of some form of impiety, failure to fulfill their obligations to family and the gods, and ends badly. Similarly, the full story of Troilus also ends badly for everyone. In the fullest version, Troilus is ambushed by Achilles, but manages to flee to the Temple of Apollo, where, in a gross act of impiety, Achilles kills him. Apollo then guides the arrow that pierces Achilles' heel and kills him. Now, based on the assumption that the audience at the time knew these stories, these recorded images then conveyed a variety of meanings to them, including images of noble death, along with the promise of the destruction of their enemies. Revenge, I think, is what explains the popularity of these stories in Etruria following Roman domination. Yes, Etruscans die for their community, but their killers will eventually suffer an even worse fate. This isn't exactly Lives of the Saints. My analysis of the urns from Perugia finds that their decorations signify a wish for Etruscan revenge on the Romans. And it's clear that this desire for revenge isn't limited to metaphorical application of Greek myth. Rather, the Etruscans seem to have never stopped resisting the Romans, even after their league sanctuary was destroyed and the local population was transferred 30 miles away after 264 BC. Their next great opportunity occurred during the Second Punic War, 218 to 202 BC. When Hannibal, the Carthaginian, invaded Italy and won a series of battles against the Romans, many of her allies and communities, under truce, shifted alliance to the Carthaginians. One of the most important of these allies was Capua, the initial Etruscan colony in Campania in southern Italy. When war broke out, it was the second city of Italy after Rome. Capua went over to Hannibal voluntarily in 216 BC and became his headquarters for a time. At Tarquinia, about 150 miles northwest of Capua, a tomb was excavated with an inscription painted on one of the walls. It reads, Felsnas, Lalethis, Svalke, Avil, and then CVI, the letters for 106, Merke, Capua, Teleke, Hannibaluscale. In English, Felsnas, son of Larth Lethe, lived 106 years. He lived at Capua, and he enlisted in the army of Hannibal. Well, I must admit to being dubious about Felsnas' professed age of 106, although it's possible, but I totally believe that he was a veteran of Hannibal's army, one of the Etruscans at Capua who viewed Hannibal as the Etruscans' best opportunity to overthrow the Romans. Of course, it didn't work out that way. After 4 years of intermittent attempts, the Romans retook Capua in 211 BC and, in revenge, executed the magistrates, local senate, and many of Capua's citizens that had supported Hannibal. Well, this was hardly the only Etruscan city to join Hannibal. It was only the largest and strategically the most significant. Gradually, through the 2nd and 1st centuries BC, the Etruscans became more integrated into Roman society. Some aristocratic families, such as the Vibii of Perugia, rose to senatorial rank. One Etruscan from Perugia became consul in 130 BC. The Emperor Augustus's advisor, Maecenas, traced his family back to the Caecina and Cilni families of Volterra and Arezzo. Now, I won't belabor the point by tracing all of the Etruscans who went on to high or influential positions in the Roman world in the 1st to 4th centuries AD. That would be tedious, and we'd all be asleep in about 5 minutes. Let's stick with the 1st century BC, though, for just a bit. Indeed, it was a period of great changes in Italy. After the 2nd and 3rd Punic Wars, great amounts of Italian territory became Roman public land, under the power of Roman aristocrats, who created vast estates farmed with slave labor. The rural poor couldn't compete and were driven off their land into the cities. Rome and its former allies in Italy, the Socii, then squared off in opposition after Rome refused the Socii's repeated requests for full Roman citizenship. This would have given them certain economic and legal benefits and protections that their current status did not. The resulting unrest and conflict led to the unfortunately named Social War from 91 to 88 BC, which was brutal. It led to the destruction of a number of the Socii communities, the siege of others, and the eventual seizure of a number of cities and land for the Roman colonies. Some of these, like Pompeii, were old Etruscan communities. For the Etruscans, as in the aftermath of the Etruscan Wars of the 3rd century BC, a religious response was called for. In this instance, the response was dramatic. Aruns Veltumnus of Cusae announced a revelation that this discontent marked the end of the 8th Etruscan Seculum. Now, according to Etruscan religious doctrine, the Etruscan people were promised by the gods 10 secula, a period of time equal to the longest possible human lifespan. That the social war was on the cusp of the 8th and 9th meant that their days were truly numbered. Now, the prophecy is long and very complicated, but it can be seen as a product of a conservative religious tradition bent on preserving the world as it was. It invokes the sacred land of the Etruscans and the organization of their society immutably into lords and slaves as a divinely sanctioned structure. It also predicted omens such as lightning and various small pests and plagues against those who violated the will of the gods and committed crimes against others. It specifically threatened those seizing land, which by coincidence or foreknowledge from the gods, the Roman dictator Sulla was about to undertake on a massive scale. One portion of the prophecy seems directed at Roman avaritia, greed. And when Jupiter claimed Etruria for himself, he determined and commanded that the land should be measured and properties marked out. Knowing the greed of men and their desire for land, he wanted to ensure that everything would be marked out with boundaries. Whenever someone, motivated by greed near the end of the 8th Seculum, whoever touches or moves the boundaries in order to improve his own holdings or to diminish the holdings of another, that man will be condemned by the gods. Well, as we'll see in a few moments, the emphasis on boundary stones plays an important role in Etruscan culture. Sulla's civil war against the Roman general Marius was fought in Etruria, And the follow-up attacks by Sulla in 83 and 82 devastated many of these Etruscan cities, Cusi included, as Sulla founded colonies, leading to wholesale massacres of populations and land confiscation. The surviving dispossessed attempted to overthrow their occupiers in 77 and 62 BC, but each uprising failed, leading to additional consequences. Perugia was the site for one of the last of these battles in 41 BC, when Octavian, the future Emperor Augustus, besieged and destroyed the city, occupied as it was by Mark Antony's forces during their struggle for power. In an act of horrific historical reference, Octavian had 300 Perugians sacrificed on the altar of Julius Caesar. This number is almost identical to the number of Romans sacrificed at Tarquinia in 356 BC. Some Etruscan haruspices, that is, priests who specialized in divination, saw this battle and its aftermath as a sign that they'd entered the 10th seculum, the final period of Etruscan history. Certainly, dramatic change had come. Oddly, it led to a sort of Etruscan revival, or perhaps more accurately, a cultural appropriation. At the close of the civil wars, the first Roman emperor, Augustus, in one of his many attempts to use traditional religion as a sort of cultural glue to unify former enemies, reestablished the Etruscan League, including its annual games and rites at the League sanctuary outside Orvieto. The Etruscan League head, Zileth Mekel Rosnol, leader of the Etruscan people as he was called, was replaced with an annually elected Praetor Etruriae. That annual Etruscan gathering survived into the 4th century AD. A sadly fragmentary statue base from Cerveteri preserves an image of personifications of three of the cities of this reconstituted league. Another element of Etruscan culture that carried through the Roman period was divination. The figure of the haruspex was an honored member of the religious establishment during the Republican period. And the College of Haruspices was restored by the Roman Emperor Claudius, a very learned man on Etruscan matters, who wrote a 20-volume work of Etruscan history and lectured the Roman Senate on Etruscan history in a speech that partially survives. That college of priests would make its final appearance in Roman history just before the Gothic attack of AD 410. The college priests at the time came to the Christian authorities in the city to offer their services, specifically citing their ability to call down lightning to strike the attackers. This offer was declined. It's the last historical instance we have confirming that Etruscan was still read, even if it might no longer have been spoken conversationally. These priestly experts in divination weren't the only sign of Etruscan cultural continuity, nor of Roman attempts to solve the problems of integrating Etruscans and dealing with their propensity for revolt. Three boundary stones set by an Etruscan colonist, or, as I think we need to consider him, exile of the fighting of this period, demonstrate the continued use of Etruscan language, culture, and religion. Marcus Unata Zutas invoked the name of the god Tin, who ensured the protection of boundaries in setting stones that established a certain parcel of land as 1,000 paces in length. Now, boundary stones aren't unusual in Etruria. What's unusual about these is that they were not found in Etruria, but in Tunisia. And the use of the Etruscan language in outlining them indicates the expectation that those reading the boundary stones would also read Etruscan. We think it means that an entire Etruscan community was founded in Tunisia on the edge of the Sahara during the turmoil of the 1st century BC. The location is significant. First, It removes the East Parian from the rich farmland of central Italy, and probably from the Etruscan city of Chiusi itself, to territory literally on the edges of the Roman world, and of questionable utility for farming. This is the former territory of Carthage, the long-term Etruscan ally going back to at least 500 BC, and with whom the southern Etruscans made common cause during that Second Punic War. We have here a rare glimpse of the other side of the land confiscations of the first century BC, the fate of the previous occupants. Interestingly, the colonists, or exiles, might not have ended up here because of the proximity of sympathetic neighbors. Rather, the boundary stones proclaim that this is now the land of the Dardanians, that is, Trojans. To add insult to injury, the texts on the boundary stones establish the former territory of Carthage as now belonging to their hated enemies, the Trojans. The period of the Etruscan colony in Tunisia is also when someone, we don't know who, wrote a linen book that's the longest work of Etruscan literature ever found. The book, or a ritual calendar, was found in Egypt, used to wrap a mummy that was made at Thebes in Upper Egypt, where actually another contemporary Etruscan colony might have existed. Ironically, or suggestively, we know that linen from Chiusi was exported to Egypt to make books during the first century AD. Whether it was to supply the needs of Egyptians or Etruscan colonists is not recorded. The links to the linen material recovered in Tunisia and Egypt reinforced the conclusion that the Romans relocated Etruscans to these outposts of the Roman Empire from the Etruscans' linen-exporting home of Chiusi. Certainly, the rich farmland at Chiusi was a desirable commodity for Sulla to settle his veterans on. But I can't help but wonder if the citizens of Chiusi weren't selected for exile as a form of exemplary punishment. It was Chiusi, after all, that led the first attacks against Rome when the Republic was founded in 509 BC. Chiusi was also the site for the grand tomb of Lars Porsena, the king who sheltered the ousted king of Rome, Tarquin. Sulla made a point of destroying that tomb when he subdued the territory. It had been the major monument in the city for over 400 years. Judging by the contemporary Roman author Varro's description, it was an amazing work that deserves a brief digression. Here's his description. Each side of this monument was 300 feet in length and 50 in height. And beneath the base, which was also square, was an inextricable labyrinth into which if anyone entered without a clue of thread, he could never find his way out. Above this square building, there stand five pyramids, one at each corner and one in the middle, 75 feet broad at the base, and 150 feet in height. These pyramids are so tapering in their form that upon the summit of all of them, united there, rests a brazen globe, and upon that a dome like a hat, from which there hang, suspended by chains, bells, which make a tinkling when agitated by the wind. Upon this globe, there are four other pyramids, each 100 feet in height, and above them, a single platform on which there are five more pyramids. I know what you're thinking. Very tasteful and understated. Or maybe that Sulla did the world a favor by eliminating that architectural monstrosity. Still, it was a statement building. Well, Chiusi, of course, was also the home of Arruns, who received the prophecy at the end of the 8th seculum of Etruscan history, with its threats against any who would seize lands that belonged to others. I think the temptation to make an example of Chiusi and its people would have been too much for the Romans to resist. So the city was attacked, its monuments destroyed, its lands confiscated, and at least some of its people exiled to North Africa. This is thorough Roman-style exemplary punishment. Nevertheless, despite all of these efforts to repress the Etruscan people and culture, they failed. We see powerful evidence of Etruscan culture's tenacity throughout the Roman period, as so many components of it had profound influences on Roman culture and retained elements of their own until the fall of the Roman world.